This is Jim Inkster. Pleased to have you with us for Talk Louisiana. Signature support from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services and from Jerry Lane Chevrolet. Robin Dow is producing. Your number is 877-217-5757. Emails to talk at talklouisiana.org. A reminder, today at 2 o'clock, the governor will be here, John Bel Edwards, for his 77th radio show. And he will talk about everything happening in our state. He's at your service, as he has been for 1 hour for 76 consecutive months. The only governor, to my knowledge, in the country doing this kind of a program. And he is now heard not only in Louisiana, but we have affiliates in Texas and in Arkansas as well. And in-house is a man who knows Governor Edwards well, Richard Zuschlag, the chairman and chief executive officer of Acadian Ambulance, one of the treasures of Louisiana. And we'll talk with him about the 50th anniversary of his company. But he is also an LSU Board of Supervisors member appointed by Governor John Bel Edwards. And it was a few weeks ago at the unveiling of the Pete Maravich statue at the Pete Maravich Assembly Center that I saw Richard. And I said he was overdue for an appearance on our program. And he said, tell me when. And so I said, August 17th. And here he is. Good morning, sir.
Well, good morning, Jim, and thanks for inviting me over here. It's always a delightful way to get my day started, and I'm always amazed after I do one of these broadcasts how many people I run into in the next couple of weeks that heard us. So you've got a pretty good audience.
Well, thank you. And you have a good audience, and also Richard has expanded into other states. But for those unfamiliar with his backstory, he's not a Louisianian. He's, of course, been in Acadiana for a half century, but he was born like Pete Maravich, and unlike Pete, he grew up in steel country, coal country, Pennsylvania.
That's right, about 60 miles north of Pittsburgh, little coal community, Greenville, Pennsylvania, in the foothills of the Appalachian Mountains, a town of about 6,000 people. And it was a great place for me to be raised, had a wonderful family. That was an industrial community. It was along the old Erie Canal Channel, and we had three different railroads coming through that town. So we had a lot of industry in our community. So I was very blessed to be raised in that small town. It's hard on me now to go back 60 years later. It's like people have all left this community. The population is down 50% of what it was when I was there. So it's a different community, and they seem to be struggling right now.
What is the name of the city?
Greenville, Pennsylvania.
Greenville, Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
Pete was from Aliquippa.
Just a few miles away, probably about 50 miles from there.
Aliquippa is also the birthplace of Tony Dorsett, Heisman Trophy winner, and Mike Ditka.
Yes.
Pro Football Hall of Famer,
yeah, former Saints. We've got a lot of football players up in that part of the
country. And then all those quarterbacks who came out of there.
Yeah.
Joe Namath, John Unitas, Joe Montana, Jim Kelly. I could go down there. There's some others I'm not mentioning. Dan Marino. It's an amazing place where athletes have bloomed, and it must be something in the water there.
And you know, I can remember my parents taking me to the zoo when I was about 12 years old in Pittsburgh, and it was so black, the smoke everywhere, soot everywhere. It was in Pittsburgh, not back up where I lived in the country. But when I go back up there now, that whole city's transformed. It's just amazing to me to see the technology and how that city has redeveloped itself.
Mm-hmm.
It is very much an IT center now there at the Three Rivers Stadium. And when I look at all the relatives I have living around the Pittsburgh area, it's just a whole new community in my mind.
Did you ever go to Forbes Field?
Yes.
When you were a kid?
Yep. Yes, I did. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But Louisiana is home, and you've told this story on our show before, but some people would say, how in the heck did Richard Zuschlag get from Pennsylvania to Louisiana and to Acadiana?
Well, you know, when I graduated in 1970 in engineering school in Washington, D.C., the Vietnam War was going on, and I was a bit apprehensive about getting drafted. They hadn't drawn up my number yet. And when Westinghouse Space and Defense came and recruited me at the school, they told me if I'd come to work for them, they'd give me a draft for a job. That piqued my interest. And so I decided to go try that out, not exactly sure where they might be sending me down the road. And sure enough, after I took the job, my draft number came in 328, and so I wasn't going to be drafted anyhow. But I worked for them for about 6 months before they were trying to determine whether to send me to Saudi Arabia or Lafayette, Louisiana. And I wasn't too excited about going to Saudi Arabia to teach them how to operate their microwave system. So they sent me to Lafayette, Louisiana. I never forget this. I drove in my old Skylark Buick with no air conditioner down to Lafayette. Got there on July 22nd, 1970. It was 96 degrees, and I had no air conditioning in my vehicle, and I wondered what the heck has happened to me, because I wasn't used to that kind of heat being raised up in Pennsylvania. It was quite traumatic for me, and I got started in a social environment where I worked at the two hospitals helping people get proper education so they could work inside the hospitals, and Westinghouse was trying to seek more federal dollars, and President Johnson was moving more and more over into social issues, and Westinghouse was very dependent on federal money from defense and other acts. So they wanted to try to tap after some of the social money, and that was one of their experiments. And I'll be very truthful. That first 6 months wasn't good for me. I didn't have any relatives down there. People spoke with that Cajun accent. They went to school in flat-bottomed canoes, and they had very highly seasoned food, and none of that adjusted well with me that first 6 months. In fact, I'd like to tell a story that I called my father and told him I was going to quit. I wanted to move back to Greenville. And he told me I wasn't allowed to come back. I made a one-year commitment to Westinghouse, and I had to stay there and finish my commitment, and it caused him and I not to get along for a while. I was really upset about them not letting me move back up to Pennsylvania.
And you stayed your 1 year, and then you formed your own company.
Yes. You know, the next 6 months was a transition, and I met some people that were very nice, and I got to have some friends that I had not had that first 6 months. And when Westinghouse got ready to send me back up to Baltimore when my program was done, is how we got founded, Acadian Embers. It's patterned after a similar, smaller company in Greenville that was based basically on a membership program. In other words, the three of us that started it had no money. I think between the three of us, we had $2,500. We couldn't borrow any money from any of the banks. Mayor Bertrand was very upset because he couldn't get proposals from any other systems around in Houston or New Orleans, and we were the only ones that had a proposal. He said we were too young to do it, and he didn't want to give us a chance. And I was very persistent. I went to see him four times. The fourth time, he called the mayor of my little town at 7 o'clock at night, and the mayor explained to him how that membership program had been successful up there. So Mayor Bertrand decided to go ahead and give us a shot and a chance, and from there, it's just amazing what happened. We used the membership program to some extent to get the capital we needed. I can remember I drove an ambulance for 2.5 years, and I wasn't a very good driver. Couldn't find my way around those Cajun dirt roads and all those bayous. But we financed the first two ambulances for 16.5% through GMAC, since the banks wouldn't loan any money. I've never forgotten that. And I remember I needed a third ambulance as a spare. So I get up early in the morning and go to the service Chevrolet and get first in line to get whatever needed to be fixed that day fixed so I could be back in service by 9 o'clock in the morning. Those were tough days, but they were learning experiences for me. And as I reflect on 50 years, I don't know how I got to where I'm at now, but there's an awful lot of people in this state that helped me develop this company, and I am so blessed to have such loyal, hardworking employees. That the employees is what made our company successful.
It's now a bellwether for the rest of the country, and you have branched into other areas, and I'm sure even you, the optimistic Richard Zuschlag, even you are amazed at the success you've had.
I work pretty long hours, and I don't take much time to sit and reflect. But since I've had grandchildren over the last few years, I have slowed down. And when I have my meditation or I have time to sit and think about things, I'm not sure how I got here. It's at times been difficult, at times it's been fun. But I think it would have been hard for me to start this kind of company in another part of the country. The Cajuns, the people in South Louisiana, are very loyal, hardworking people, very strong Christians. In our area, of course, it's 65-70% Catholic. And I was Methodist when I moved to Lafayette after I got married to a great Catholic girl out in Roebridge.
You converted?
I converted. And it's been a very good experience for me. But when you treat your employees above average, and we've done that through this ESOP, we've been very successful. Russell Long wrote an ESOP law that he told me right before he died, I was one of the few ESOPs that did it the right way to take care of the employees. In other words, when my two partners exited in 98, we sold their shares of stock to the ESOP trust and borrowed the money to float that loan. And so employees were able to receive stock every year depending on how well we do for their retirement. And that ESOP then goes into the retirement. And I want to tell you something right now. In the last 8 years, we've handed out $280 million of people retiring or terminating their employment. And it's been a real good experience for me.
877-217-5757 and talk at talklouisiana.org for Richard Zuschlag, the chairman of Canadian Ambulance. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. With us is Richard Zuschlag, pride of Greenville, Pennsylvania, who has logged the last 50 years plus, 51 now, in Louisiana. He came to Lafayette on 7/22/1970. So that's 52 years. And he, for the first 2.5 years that he owned Acadian Ambulance, he was a driver. So you didn't have the proverbial silver spoon.
Do you know that I was blessed to have the Vietnam medics? They had been through a lot of traumatic injuries during that war. And we went from the funeral home ambulance service to a more upgraded system where we were actually saving lives. And the doctors and Lafayette were very helpful to me. And when they saw these Vietnam medics, they gave us standing orders to save lives. And we didn't have to call them every time we needed to start an IV or issue medication. And we had Vietnam medics from the Air Force, from the Navy, from the Coast Guard, from the Army. The Marines didn't have medics. They had to use the Navy medics. But they would all have a contest in who was better at this skill. And I loved the way they came to work because there were not paramedics and EMTs back then. And those Vietnam medics gave us the credibility to really start growing because the doctors were very cooperative. They could see that we were doing a much better professional service. In fact, I can still remember the board of Lafayette General calling me in and somewhat fussing at me back in 75, telling me that because we were saving so many lives, they couldn't use the program where a doctor was on call for the ER. They had to go out and hire full-time doctors to put in the emergency room. Mm-hmm. And I just know the whole program that we got started was a community effort. We didn't do it by ourselves. A lot of people helped us. So I feel very blessed about that.
877-217-5757, your number, and talk at Talk Louisiana, our email. I've gotten a few emails. And Richard Zuschlag, of course, is a guy who just effuses enthusiasm, and he's been doing this. The 50th anniversary of his company officially ends in September, but it's been quite a ride, literally, for Richard Zuschlag. And I'm one of those people who is a survivor because of Acadian. It was in 2004. I had a car wreck and broke my neck and had to get to a hospital quickly, was bleeding out. And your guys and girls got me there quickly enough. I was in Napoleonville. They got me to Baton Rouge, Our Lady of the Lake. And I, with a broken neck, if they had moved me the wrong way, I could have been dead or paralyzed, but they did that well, and they got me there in time. Airlifted me, of course, and it was without Acadian, I wouldn't be here doing a radio show 18 years later.
I really appreciate you sharing that with me. I spent a lot of my time working on things that go wrong, but there's an awful lot of things that have gone right. And I realized that in 50 years, our company has transported 12.5 million patients. And I know some of those are alive today because of what our medics did in the field. Our company is not perfect. We're not the best. But we work a little bit harder each day and each week to be better at what we're doing. And I just feel blessed with the support from the elected officials and from the medical community to allow us to operate. You know, we're regulated by local government with our response times and our pricing, and that works by parish and city by city. So they get a chance to look at our books and see what we're doing. And so I kind of look at us somewhat as a private company, but it's a public utility, so to speak. And I think having this ESOP where 80% of the company is owned by the employees, the Zuslaw family still retains the other 20%. I think the ESOP has really helped us be able to grow the company because it's a lot easier for me to come to Baton Rouge or to Washington and ask for assistance in areas where we're not doing well or we need additional funding to raise salaries. Mm-hmm. I'm asking on behalf of an employee-owned company. It's not just for my family. It's an employee-owned company that's serving the best interest of the state. And you know, I have so much respect for our current governor. We really work well with government, and the way he has tapped into everybody, whether they're Republican, Democrats, or independents, he gets everybody involved when it comes to all these floods and all these hurricanes. Not any of the other governors used to do that. It was too political for me, but everybody is included in the planning and the staging. Mm-hmm. And I just can tell you, our emergency response to these natural disasters has made a big, big improvement since he's taken that over. And I feel kind of bad for him in his 6 years of being governor. He's had to deal with the coronavirus and all these storms, and it's kept him very busy but very energized, and I think he's done a great job.
And he asked you, and you readily accepted, an appointment on the LSU Board of Supervisors, 3 years now. And that's a job that has some perks. It's nice to get good seats to football games, but occasionally there's controversy, and you hired a new president during that time. Your thoughts about William Tate?
Well, let me first say this. Me and one of the people sitting next to me from the Monroe area got appointed at the same time. And after a lot of things started going wrong with the sexual situations, with accusations being made with our Title IX program, we got a lot of criticism, but we weren't there when that happened. But yet we were there trying to get it all corrected. There was a few months where he and I thought, maybe we should get off this board. How did this all happen to us? Because we had coronavirus, so we couldn't travel with a team. We couldn't go to some of the football games. All the perks that we were supposed to get, we didn't get any of them for a couple of years. But then we got to thinking that we asked to be on it. Governor appointed us. We need to stay here and get things right. And I'll just say this. Dr. Tate has made a huge impact and is well-respected. And he is a very intelligent man that works very hard with all parts of our society. He personally got involved more with the legislature this last year. And one of the things he did that turned the key for me is he got all the campuses on the same page so that everybody was asking for mm-hmm. the same thing. In previous years, LSU New Orleans and Shreveport and Alexandria and Eunice all had their own agendas of what they wanted from the legislature. And that caused a lot of chaos inside the legislature. This time, he went on a unified situation, and I think that brought back dividends to the whole LSU campus, to the whole LSU system across the state. So I have a lot of respect for what he's doing. I'm very intrigued about he thinks athletes are important. Football coach is very important. We got to have the best. But he also wants to make sure that we're getting the best professors and people in research. He wants to have them be sought after and paid like the football coach so that we have the best research in the country. He has a lot of good positive ideas, and he's really pushing hard right now for more money for scholarships. He's got a big program for scholarships to be able to bring in intelligent young people that can make a difference in our world but just don't have the financial capability of getting on the campus. And I just really admire what he's doing. Richard Lipsy and I have joined together with our duck camps down in Cameron. And towards the end of November, we're hosting a large hunt between mm-hmm. the two camps with about hopefully 30 to 35 guests. And between the two camps, we're planning on raising $500,000 for Dr. Tate for scholarships. Now, he came hunting last year for his first time ever. And I can tell you he's not really excited about it, but he doesn't dislike it. He needs to practice shooting a little bit more, and he'll get into it. But the fact is that he was willing to go out there on the marsh and hunt with us was great, and he's coming back again this year.
Isaac on Essen. Isaac, you're on. Good morning. You're on with Richard Zuschlag.
Good morning, Jim. How you doing this morning? Good morning, Mr. Katie. I'm a dialysis patient. You have been transporting me for almost 15 years, 3 days a week. You got some of the greatest people that I've ever run into. I'm a Vietnam veteran. I've been all over the world, and these people are great.
Well, I really appreciate you taking time to share that with me. I feel very blessed. I've got about 5,200 employees, and most of them are really top-notch people, and they try very hard to do what's right. We want to have excellent patient care, and we want to treat our patients with dignity. We want to have good customer service, and as I mentioned earlier, we do make some mistakes, but we try not to make them more than once.
877-217-5757 and talk at talklouisiana.org for Richard Zuschlag, who'll be with us a bit longer, and then we'll hear from Jason Berry, one of the best journalists in the world. And when we come back, we'll talk about worker shortages. Is it affecting Acadian Ambulance? A listener asked a good question. We'll talk about it. This is Jim Inkster. A few more minutes with the incomparable Richard Zuschlag, Chairman and Chief Executive Officer, Acadian Ambulance. Started his company about 51 years ago. He's been in Louisiana for 52. And when he came here, he thought, oh, my goodness, what have I gotten myself into? And before we get back to the topic at hand, and we'll take a call or two as well. Richard Zuschlag is noted, is from Greenville, Pennsylvania. And I remember many years ago, first time I met him, he told me he had a background in radio at a station called WGRP.
What's Greenville really progressed?
Not KRP, this WGRP.
Yes.
Greenville, Pennsylvania.
And, you know, I was in high school when I got asked to take the shift of somebody that left. And I didn't know how to do that. My boss told me I couldn't use Richard Zuschlag, so he helped me come up with my handle. It was Dick Richards. I was Dick Richards, DR the DJ, at WGRP, home of the Lakeland's Music Explosion, because we're right south of Lake Erie and all the other little lakes around there. And I might have had 200 or 300 people listening, but it was a great experience for me. I would do the news on Saturday and Sunday mornings for them. And I learned a lot doing that at a young age and worked my way through college doing that.
WGRP, Dick Richards.
Yes.
Who became Richard Zuschlag. Now, what about the worker situation right now? You're always looking not only for workers, but good workers. Is there an issue at all?
This is the biggest crisis I've ever faced. We are really struggling because it takes 18 months to train paramedics. Now, I'm spending a lot of extra money right now in doing that in a six-month period where I'm paying them to go to school because they have no way of earning an income if they're going to school full-time. I'm also doing that for some EMTs because we are extremely short manpower. It's impeding our growth right now. I think we're doing an excellent job on 911 calls. We're not doing so well on transporting patients from one hospital to another throughout the state. That's causing a great big delay for us right now. And so we've given a 30% raise over the last 3 years.
30% raise.
Yeah.
877-217-5757. A few more minutes with Richard Zuschlag. Nick in College Town. Hi, Nick. You're on with Richard.
Hey, good morning, Jim. Good morning, Richard. You were talking earlier about all the people that help you build Acadian Ambulance. I'm actually headed to Lake Charles later today for an event honoring Bill Oliver, and I just thought maybe you could comment on the role the late Bill Oliver played as president of AT&T in working with you to build Acadian Ambulance.
Well, Jim, you're one of the people that were very helpful to me when I first met Senator or Congressman Breaux way back when he first moved from Crowley to Washington. And Congressman Breaux and then Senator Breaux always worked really hard to help me out, and I can remember you worked with him in the beginning, so I've always had a lot of respect for you. Bill Oliver and I became close friends. He was an engineer for Bell South, and he helped me negotiate with his chairman, Lafayette, becoming the first 911 operation in the state to have the enhanced system to where when somebody dialed 911, we got the street address, and we also got the name the person, and that really helped us put that into the computer so that we could call up a membership and see what kind of medicines or illnesses the patient had. We tied all that together. Bill Oliver was not just a great person, but he did a lot to teach me how to work with the legislature and the government up in Washington, D.C., and he's one of many that has helped me get to where I'm at, and I will always be grateful for his guidance in those many years. He's the one also that started bringing some of the influential people, like the chairman of the board of Bell South, down to my duck lodge. And then after that started happening, Trent Lott and John Bro would come, and Billy Tozen would come, and it just kept growing and growing and growing. So the Duck Camp did a lot to help build our company through relationships.
Well, you were appointed by Governor Edwards 3 years ago, and the governor will be on our show, his show, 2 o'clock today, the 77th Ask the Governor program. He put you on the LSU Board of Supervisors, and he's, of course, a huge LSU fan. And a listener asked about Brian Kelly. You really weren't involved in the negotiations. I'm answering the listener's questions, but you did have to approve his contract, a big one. And do you think he's going to be worth the investment?
I know it's always a little bit of controversy, and I'm not an expert in athletic events. I've taken a real liking to him. He has a lot of discipline. He's a very smart individual. I think he will do a great job. We have to be patient and give him time. It's hard to make a prediction for this year because he didn't have all the time to do his own recruiting, but I'm seeing a lot of new talent coming in. I think he has surrounded himself with some excellent assistant coaches. That is a big moneymaker. The football program pays for most all those other athletic programs for the women and men. Without that, we would be in a big mess financially. And you know, when we have wins and we get on that national television, you wouldn't believe what that does to bring more out-of-state people to come and want to go to LSU. So it is a very good program. We ought to do the same thing now in our research and have people coming here because of the outstanding research and academics that we have. And that's why we're going to work on this scholarship program and help President Tate get the kind of faculty and students that mm-hmm. he wants.
Lastly, I alluded to it, but a listener asked me to follow up. How many states are you currently in with Acadian?
Louisiana, Texas, Tennessee, and Mississippi.
4 states.
Yeah. But we have a lot of other divisions. We have a safety management system that's across the country, and we have a security system mm-hmm. that does alarms that has outlets all across the country.
Well, Richard Zuschlag, it's always good to catch up with you, and I am inspired by your enthusiasm.
Jim, it was really nice of you to ask me to participate this morning. I'm delighted to be here, and I wish you good luck, and I hope you have a nice interview this afternoon with the governor.
Thank you, sir. And now as we round the corner and head for home, we've got more than a quarter hour to go with Jason Berry, one of the best journalists in the world, a New Orleanian who was the first person on the beat reporting sexual abuse in the priesthood of the Catholic Church, a church of which he is still a member. And he is passionate about his hometown. And as far as modern day journalism goes, he has written the definitive work about New Orleans, City of a Million Dreams. And he is concerned, like many of us, about the rampant violence in our country and also what in the world is going on in New Orleans. Jason's latest essay starts this way. 58% of households have no gun, a data point of hope, he writes, amid the bloody tide of gun violence. Most of us in that 58%, he writes, believe that schools, churches, synagogues, malls, stores, and post offices can somehow be restored as safer sites without fear of a psychopath wielding an assault weapon. And in New Orleans, a population with 391,000, down immensely from the days when I was a kid and Jason was a kid, a poverty-stricken city, but the crown jewel of Louisiana, plagued with crime. Homicides are up 150%. 145 murders as of July 5th, the nation's highest murder rate per capita. Jason, there's a real issue. We've talked about it for years. In the 90s, New Orleans had years in which more than 400 people were killed, and things got better. But now we're trending in the wrong direction. Your thoughts, my friend?
Well, that's quite a sweeping intro. Thank you, Jim. I have a couple of thoughts, and I should say that the article I did for the Daily Beast came about because I was really curious about the underlying causes of gun violence being so widespread, and I built the article really around two people, Larry Preston Williams, a retired NOPD detective and who had done security consulting as well, and Neil Curran, who is now a Bible church pastor in Dallas, but got his start in New Orleans, interestingly, as a Democrat, changed parties, became a evangelical. So to cut to the chase, I think there are a couple of entwined realities here. One is that we have seen a staggering surge in gun sales over the last 15 years. This is abundantly documented. And there is also a great surge in the theft of guns and the selling of illegal guns in cities. Larry Williams, who was once a street cop, told me that when he was a patrolman back in the 70s, he never had fear of being shot at by a criminal. Well, now criminals have guns that are often, you know, used in military exercises, and so police, in a sense, are facing a different level of weaponry. And by the same token, in these terrible mass shootings, we see deranged young men get access to military weapons. So the first thought that came to me is that this is, I hate to put it crassly, but this is, in a sense, an issue of free market capitalism. If you believe that the market in any product, be it a gun or a car or you know, pharmaceuticals, should be absolutely unregulated, and as I understand it, this is what libertarians believe, well, here we are. You know, guns are being sold and resold, and there's an enormous black market in the sale of guns. That was one thing that struck me. The other thing that struck me in doing the research is that the Obama administration saw violence in America decline dramatically. And yet, in those very years, the sale of guns escalated dramatically. Remarkable that one line goes up, the other line goes down. And a lot of it, I think, was because the NRA kept promoting the idea that Obama wanted to take guns away from people, which wasn't really the case. But I yield counsel. That's my opening statement.
Well, you note other cities are having problems, and some like New Orleans, the great treasures of our country. Austin, Texas, for example, murder up 86%. But Dallas, it's dropped 13%. We're about to head to a break, but I know you've looked into what's going on in Dallas, and I think sometimes it's good to stop talking and start analyzing and find places where they are doing things that are working, and maybe something is being done there that should be replicated in New Orleans and in Baton Rouge and in other places across our country, because it is a significant problem. 877-217-5757 and talk at talklouisiana.org for Jason Berry. We return after this brief timeout with more Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Jason Berry, the prolific writer from New Orleans, who is now writing near and far, and one of the places where you read his words is the Daily Beast. He has quite an expose on gun violence in America and in New Orleans, where unfortunately, in a dubious category, we're number one, New Orleans is, in the country, and Baton Rouge is not far behind in per capita murders. But Dallas, well, our cities, big ones in Louisiana, are showing upticks in murders. Dallas has dropped 13%. Is there anything happening there, or is this just blind luck, Jason?
Well, yeah. Eddie Garcia is the chief of police, and he implemented a wide-ranging plan to go to the sources of poverty and try to beef up a protective presence in policing, and to make sure, for example, that empty houses were kept up so that they're not just, you know, derelict places where people might gather for, you know, whatever activity. And they also have a sort of proactive strategy in public housing projects. It's a whole list of things. If the listeners are interested, Bloomberg did a terrific article on it that I cited as a link in my piece. But I think if you look at the contrast with New Orleans, part of the problem is that we are severely undermanned in NOPD. the based on population, the police department should have about 1,600 officers, and we're below 900. Now, the department is under a federal consent decree with the Justice Department, and as I understand it, Mayor Cantrell is trying to get that removed. I suppose there are a lot of politics there, but one way or another, when you are down 700 police officers, you don't have the capacity to cover the territory that you do when you have 1,600. So, you know, these are issues of local politics. They involve funding, public support, how you do these things. But I think that does that, coupled with the fact that, well, as Larry Williams said in the article, the fellow I quoted, former NOPD guy, he said you can go into any bar in some of the worst neighborhoods in town, and if you want to buy a gun, you know, there's a certain guy you can go to. You can find him. You give him money. You might give him something else, whatever, and he'll come back in a short while, and you'll have a gun. We've got to stop that. The gun economy is a runaway market, and I think it needs much stronger regulation, in my view.
This guy, Larry Williams, you were mentioning, there's a great photo of him, January 7th, 1973, at Howard Johnson's. Remember the massacre in New Orleans?
A
terrorist used a sniper rifle. He shot some police officers that he lured to the Civic Center. There's Larry Williams. And 50 years later, he's got more stories, but my goodness, he was in the line of fire.
He was indeed. He was indeed. I remember when that happened. I think everybody who is of a certain age who lived in New Orleans at the time remembers when Mark Essex was on top of the, we didn't know his name at the time. That didn't come out till a day or two later, but he shot quite a number of people before he himself was shot. You know, this is one of those events that's now, what an understatement, one of these horrors that is now cataloged by the Gun Violence Project. And I think there's something like 30 mass shootings going back to, I believe it was 1967, when a young man in Austin, Texas, got up on a bell tower and just started shooting people.
It was Charles Whitman, 1966, August 1st.
Hey, there you go.
66.
I stand revised. Yeah, I believe I don't have the article in front of me, but according to the Gun Violence Project, if I'm correct, of the 30 mass shootings that have been documented so far, going back almost 60 years now, seven have been in Texas. And, you know, one of the turnkey issues in that governor's race right now, Beto O'Rourke, the former congressman, is running against Greg Abbott, the incumbent governor. And O'Rourke is making the issue of gun violence and says they've got to break the what he calls the chokehold with the NRA and agree to much stronger legal mechanisms to prevent guns from being sold. We know that many of the guns that the Mexican cartels have are bought in the United States and go over the border illegally. You know, we do a better job of stopping people from coming into the country over the border than stopping the flow of guns out of the United States into Mexico. So these are some of the paradoxes and conflicts that I think we're facing, but these are epic issues.
David in Atlanta. David, you're on with Jason Berry.
Good morning, gentlemen. Mr. Berry, given your research and background into Catholic priests molesting young boys, you know, there was a scene in the movie The People versus Larry Flint, which I won't discuss on family radio, but have you found similar behavior among Catholic nuns and young girls?
That's a different segue,
yes.
But go ahead. Go ahead, Jason.
Well, the answer to the question is yes. There have been well-documented cases involving religious sisters, not nearly as high numerically as involved priests or brothers, but yes, especially in some of the training schools of Native Americans, as they're referred to in the Midwest and the Northeast and in Mexico. New Mexico, yes, but that phenomenon does exist.
And religion is certainly pervasive in our country in the political realm. In fact, you quote in your piece a book called Jesus and John Wayne, how white evangelicals corrupted a faith and fractured a nation. This macho stuff about being more manly by carrying a gun, to get back where we started, a lot of that is based in religion, isn't it?
It is indeed. Kristen Demez, the author who teaches at Calvin University, I don't know if she's a former evangelical or not, but she certainly knows the inner workings of the religious movement. You know, what I think we're going through, and this sort of riffs off of what she says in the book Jesus and John Wayne, we're living in an era when the old American myth of endless space, that we can constantly move westward, we can take men to the moon, that myth is closing down. And the border is a perfect example. Pouring all this money, Donald Trump making an issue of rapists coming across the border. You know, the border, in a sense, is the issue that has taken that idea of endless growth and pulled it back down to the ground. On the other hand, we are a people, a country, under the belief of E Pluribus Unum, you know, from the many come the one, or from the one come the many, that pluralism. And we don't have a myth of pluralism to take the place of that idea of endless space. And that is what I think we're searching for. We are a diverse social mosaic. That is our country. And, you know, the white supremacists and so much of what Donald Trump has proposed, Make America Great Again, which I think a lot of people see as a dog whistle, Make America White Governed Again. All of that is not going to happen. It's not in the cards demographically, and even mm-hmm. with Trump's support, I just don't see it happening politically. So we're searching for a new myth, a new idea of who we are as America.
Well, on this show yesterday, we had one of our callers, Gustavo in Goodwood, saying the era of Trump is over and that liberals should get over it. Well, in Wyoming last night, we got full evidence that the era of Trump is still alive and well.
Oh, absolutely. Liz Cheney went down, as I think many people expected. And, you know, it's ironic that she has been leading the charge on the January 6th commission, or one of the people leading the charge in the House, and yet she couldn't sustain her base in Wyoming. So the Trump movement is strong indeed, and with all of his legal problems, I mean, it seems likely he's going to get indicted somewhere. But I think the larger question is what happens to the expectations he raised? I mean, if I have no idea whether Ron DeSantis has what it takes to get the nomination, but if for argument's sake he does, will that idea of constantly restricting the kinds of changes as he's done in Florida? Florida's down almost 40% in the number of school teachers they need. You know, we need a strategy of growth and security in order to face the overwhelming crisis of climate change, and I don't see that coming from the right.
Jason Berry, it's always good to talk with you, and thanks for what you do. Glad you're in the game and have been for so many years.
Jim, it's always my pleasure. Thank you.
See you soon. And talk about a New Orleanian true and true. He is one. He loves the city with all its flaws. It is still the crown jewel of Louisiana, and people from all over the world come to New Orleans. Signature support for our show, Talk Louisiana, is from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services and from Jerry Lane Chevrolet. For Robin Dow, I'm Jim Inkster. Back tomorrow, same time, same place. Until then, stay safe and stay tuned.